public hearing again, and we'll start with,
let's see, we have...
We're going to, apparently, it looks like Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Administration is up next.
Okay, good morning.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we thought the flow of the questions would make sense to have OSHA come up next. I'd like to introduce Pete DeLuca, the Administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Peter DeLuca. I'm the Administrator of the Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Division, commonly known as Oregon OSHA. OSHA, of course, is an acronym. It's our common name. It refers to the federal program that we're kind of tied to. Our executive summary begins on page 36. 46, I'm sorry. Purpose of Oregon OSHA, our mission, is to advance and improve workplace safety and health for all workers in the state of Oregon. Oregon OSHA is a program which operates essentially in conjunction with a federal program, and that would be OSHA. In the early 70s, under President Nixon, Congress passed the Occupational Safety and Health Act on a federal level, creating OSHA. And part of that act provides that if a state wants to run its own occupational safety and health program, it can do so as long as it is at least as effective as a federal program. 23 states, including Oregon, have chosen to run their own plans. The remaining states, the occupational safety and health is taken care of by the federal government. Our recent history is a history of partnership. I think it's safe to say that cooperative efforts are our hallmark. We have numerous joint commissions and committees made up of business and labor and government. We see it as somewhat of a three-legged stool. If it's good for business and labor and government, then it's going to work. If it isn't good for one of those three legs, then it's not going to work. And no matter how hard we might try to make it work, it just won't work. So the actions that we take, we do in conjunction with business and labor, and we try to make it work for everybody. Out of this partnership, there's something to be gained by both business and labor. You've heard testimony with respect to the amounts of money that have been saved based upon workers' comp premium. Recently, that figure was $5 billion, and I think Debbie testified to that last week. In addition to that, most experts in this field will tell you that the indirect costs to employers of accidents is at least double and maybe quadruple the amount of the premiums that are saved. So indirect costs include such things as replacing the worker who is no longer on the job, retraining, lost time due to people not working during the course of an accident, lost time because of morale. A large number of factors, and as I said, some industry experts will estimate that up to four times. Many others say at least it's double that. So you can take that $5 billion figure and extrapolate and see that this system, and it's not just Oregon OSHA, this is Oregon OSHA working in conjunction with the other people in the system, but this system has saved business an awful lot of money, so it's good for business. With respect to employees, obviously it's good for employees too. Our goal is to send everybody home at the end of the day in the same basic condition as they came to work. And obviously nobody wants to get hurt at work. Workplace safety is one of the things that unions first organized around and one of the first issues that they raised. And OSHA is a product of that, and we work very hard to try and send people home the same way they came to work. Our list of accomplishments, I should say a partial list, is found on page 48. I'd like to bring your attention to a couple of things that are not there that we've already talked about. Reduced injuries, reduced comp rates, but I think one of the most significant figures that I can give you is that of reduced fatalities. We had in 1988 81 compensable fatalities in this state, and in 1999 we had 47. This last year, the year 2000, we had 43. This number is a number which has been cut in half. Now, the number of total fatalities, not just compensable, but total, has reduced proportionally the same way that the compensable fatalities have reduced. And while you can get some control over the number of compensable injuries based upon the entrance exam or the entrance requirements into the system, fatalities is one number that you really can't alter very much or control very much. And when we see this reduction in fatalities, which shows a downward trend year after year, we see this as a very, very positive accomplishment. In addition,
thank you, and I'm sorry, I don't know what the policy is relative to how you'd like to take questions, interim. But I would like to know this is a striking decrease from 1988. What are national statistics? If they mirror that, if we're doing better or worse than national, if that information could be made available.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I can have that information
thank
for you tomorrow. I believe you'll see that we're doing a little bit better than the national average in this regard, but I will have that information for you tomorrow. Some of our other successes are listed on page 48, and rather than read them all, I'm going to highlight just a few of these. In 1999, we established a partnership committee, which operates essentially as an informal board of directors of Oregon OSHA. This committee includes business leaders, labor leaders, various organizations across the state, including the AFL-CIO, the Associated Oregon Industries, Associated Oregon Loggers, a variety of different unions, building trades people, and we gather those people together every quarter and talk to them about the direction we're going, about things that we're going to do or have on the planning board, and also get just kind of a pulse or a temperature in terms of how they think we're doing. So they operate as an ad hoc kind of advisory body for us, and their establishment in 1999, I think, is one of the major successes of the prior biennium. In 1999, the legislative session established a different, slightly different weighting system in terms of how we do our scheduled inspections. We've always tried to go to employers that need the most attention, but the legislation passed in 2830, which was the bill number in the last session, is clearly an indication that the legislature wants us to go to the worst places first. So we've revamped our scheduling system. In order to revamp it, again, we convened a task group of stakeholders, including business and labor, and put some OSHA people there, so we had the government component. And they worked for a good long period of time. I might add that one of the people on that committee was the sponsor of the bill, and to his credit, Representative Krupp was at almost all the committees. You could kind of sometimes expect that he'll drop in once in a while and check and see how things are going, but he was a very diligent member of the committee and assisted us greatly, and I think we came up with a scheduling system now that is much more acceptable to the major stakeholders, the people that we ultimately inspect, and also acceptable to labor as well. During the past biennium, we produced over 14 safety and health conferences. The largest one of those is the Governor's Occupational Safety and Health Conference. It takes place in Portland at the Convention Center under the two glass towers. It fills that entire facility. We had over 2,000 people in attendance, paid attendance, and then we had another 1,000 who were exhibitors or speakers or in some other way connected with the conference. It is one of the largest safety conferences in the nation, I think, to the best of my knowledge, the largest on the West Coast, and it draws people from all up and down the coast and also inland in places like Idaho and Utah and Nevada. We conducted over 11,000 health and safety inspections in the past biennium and over 4,000 consultations. And ergonomics, I wouldn't be right if I didn't mention ergonomics here today. course, as you know, the federal government promulgated ergonomics rules. The Congress set them aside. And just so that everybody understands where Oregon OSHA is with respect to ergonomics, we have no independent plans of going ahead with ergonomic regulations. Nonetheless, the issue does exist. And prior to the time that the rules were set aside, we had a task force involved in the issue advising us as to what direction we might take. We actually put this task force together in the middle of 1999, during which time there was a lot of controversy brewing. They were responsible for helping us to put on one of our 14 conferences, which was strictly on the subject of ergonomics. I'm going to ultimately draw from that task force and appoint a steering committee to talk more about what we should do, but I frankly don't think we're going to go into the regulation area anytime soon, so that's kind of a dead issue. On the other hand, the topic of ergonomics, because about 40% of our injuries occur as a result of soft tissue repetitive motion type injuries, is something which won't go away. And if we're going to continue to reduce injuries in the workplace, we're going to have to begin to address that in some fashion. So the purpose of keeping this group alive and keeping it going is to assist those employers who want to be assisted so that we can continue to address ergonomic situations.
Representative, or Senator Dukes is recognized.
The work group that you had, were they, I take it they haven't reached a conclusion yet, or perhaps won't because of the federal changes, but were they leaning toward regulation or not toward regulation?
Senator Dukes, this was a really interesting work group. I mean, we literally put this group together from anybody who was interested. All you had to do to be a part of the group was show up. And so we had a cross-section of people. Some people just hate the word ergonomics. Other people live and breathe it and want to think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. So that's one thing that came out of the group. There was no consensus whatsoever. We asked them initially whether or not they thought we should attempt to formulate our own regulation. And because of the diversity on the group and the divergence of opinion, the only conclusion we could draw was that they did not want us to move in that direction. What they wanted us to do was work more in terms of educating people and assisting people.
I understand you to say that from the work group you're going to appoint a steering committee?
Right.
Is the steering committee going to be able to come to any kind of conclusion?
Inclination is that the steering committee will probably continue to move in the direction that we're moving, which is more education, more assistance for employers, a clearinghouse of information for employers, but not in the area of regulation.
Okay, then I just have one request. Could you step this up a little bit? I first heard the term ergonomics in the 1980s, and people are still losing time at work and having to be retrained and all of that because of carpal tunnel and because of vision problems and things that we've done studies for the last 15, 20 years. So, I mean, it'd be nice if we had, if we're going to educate, which is an excellent thing to do, that if we would help educate people as to how they can avoid it, employers and employees, sooner rather than later. And I mean, we've known for longer than that that chairs that aren't appropriately adjusted and the wrong chairs and all of that cause back problems. So,
Senator Dukes, I couldn't agree with you more.
One more study group is not going to get us.
Well, this isn't a study group per se, but it is a group to help educate people in terms of the need to address this problem. And I think, frankly, if we talk about it in those terms and we let people understand that there are solutions to these problems, and we also help people to understand that those solutions are not going to bankrupt them or put them out of business. I mean, that's the key right here as far as I'm concerned. There's been a lot of misinformation about ergonomics that it's going to put people out of business, and it was never intended to do that. And I think people need to understand that it's something, if they address it, that can help them and help them reap big benefits.
Just one follow-up in that regard. You've had the work group, no consensus within the work group. Your indication is in Oregon. We have no independent plans are proceeding on an ergonomics program. However, you are forming a steering committee from the work group. Tell me how you, just briefly, if you would, please, Mr. Lucas, how you anticipate that would work out. Who do you select from the work group onto the steering committee?
Well, Representative Butler, I think we've got to be very careful about who we select, but I would suggest, I've spoken already to Lisa Trussell from Associated Oregon Industries, and she's indicated an interest. I've spoken with Brad Witt from the AFL-CIO, and he has indicated an interest. I would suggest that we get a couple of more people from labor and a couple of more people from business, and we put them together and see what kinds of ideas they might generate. But as I said earlier, I think that a regulation until such time as business is, how should I say, ready for it, accepting of it, is going to be something that's just not going to reap us any benefit. But at the same time, I think that if these people want to get together and they want to talk about it and they want to try and figure out how they can take what is known about ergonomics and make businesses more profitable, make workers less vulnerable, then it's a good result, and that's what we're looking for.
I had one other question relative to the, I think, about bullet point number 7 or 8 there. Surveyed all businesses receiving inspection consultation to determine quality of interaction between Oregon OSHA and its stakeholders. Could you provide us the results of that survey, please?
Representative Butler, I can provide you with results. We have that all tabulated. I can tell you right now that about 90% of the results on our inspections have been very favorable.
Thank you. If you just provide that as a...
Certainly. Yeah, we can do that tomorrow.
Yes, Senator Dukes, I beg your pardon.
I'm assuming you didn't really mean to say that we're not going to get very far until business is ready to accept this. Like I said, I first heard about ergonomics in the 1980s. Business hasn't exactly leapt through hoops to get there. And if the vast majority of businesses care very much about their employees, but mitigate that with the bottom line, and I agree with you that ergonomics doesn't have to be expensive, but if the agency is going on the theory that when business is ready for it, then we'll get there, or OSHA wouldn't exist.
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, what we are talking about working with business on is actually promulgating mandatory regulations. We have had ergonomists on our staff for quite some time and have always worked on soft tissue injuries, and we'll continue to do that. We provide information, we provide consultations on it, and there are probably the majority of businesses who are interested in seeing these injuries go away. So we have been working on it. We have a very active program on these kinds of injuries, but as was demonstrated with the federal regulations, there's still an awful lot of disagreement about what has to be mandated or what should be mandated, what kind of regulations ought to go out. So we're not going to pursue promulgating regulations. We certainly are going to pursue them very aggressively, the fact that people are hurt through carpal tunnel, through soft tissue injuries, and we're not going to let up on that.
The federal regulations, I believe, were pulled back for political reasons, and I don't expect that from our OSHA, because over the last probably 10 years, I've seen a lot better, so I assume that we're going to move forward on that. For me, it's just as simple as there are hundreds of people every year who live with a lot of pain because of the kinds of things that ergonomics can help us with, and if they happen to be employed by an employer who isn't one of the vast majority and isn't interested in fixing it, that shouldn't be their downfall. because the employer didn't want to move forward. And we have an agency saying if they don't want to move forward, we're not going to push them.
Okay. Any other questions? Go forward then.
With respect to our funding, Oregon OSHA currently is funded about 65% with state funds and about 35% with federal funds. If you look on page 46, there's an organizational chart which lays out most of our programs. Let me give you the high points. Our consultation program is the most active consultation program in the nation. If this budget request is accepted, we will have 36 consultants. Their purpose is to assist employers when the employers ask for assistance. This is a no-cost program. It is separate from enforcement in that we have what we call a firewall, which separates enforcement from consultation. If a consultant is on site and finds problems, then that is not reported to enforcement. That stays with consultation. Our assumption is that people wouldn't call us and ask us to help them if they didn't want to fix what we find. So, and as I said earlier, 4,000 consultations in a biennium, about 2,000 consultations per year is what we do. Our enforcement program is the biggest program that we have. We have 80 compliance officers. This, again, is the largest enforcement program of anywhere in the nation. We have more compliance officers per capita in the state of Oregon than anybody else does. We have done everything that we can in the past 5 years to turn our enforcement program into a learning experience whenever possible. We believe that when we're on site that the business should get more of a positive information type thing than just negativity from us, basically that we're worth the price of admission. On the other hand, we are more than willing to deal with serious offenders, and we have examples of those that have occurred over the years. Not too long ago at the airport, we issued the largest fine that we've ever issued, $1.5 million. And so we will deal seriously with those serious offenders. But we also believe that when we're out on the job, we should be helping employers. We did 5,300 inspections last year. And as a result of the change in the way we do scheduling, we anticipate, frankly, somewhat fewer inspections next year simply because it's more difficult to find the worst employers. Many of them are small employers. Many of them are in Oregon for a short period of time. Many of them don't have an office where we can go and find them. Sometimes they have a trailer. Sometimes they have a home. And so we go there and we don't find anybody at work. And it's a little bit more difficult when we're doing that worst first business than it is if we were doing inspection scheduling the way we did last biennium. On the other hand, we're going through a learning process, and I think that before too long we'll be right back up to where we were before.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Austin. Thank you. Could I just explore with you? You said you issued the largest fine that had ever been issued at the airport. To try to put together all of the statements that you just made, that generally you try to work with businesses and that then you've issued this huge fine, is it safe to say that there was a reluctance to work with your folks, or was this a surprise inspection that yielded a great number of violations? Tell us a little bit about the chronology of what ends up in $1.5 million fine.
All right, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson. If you'll remember, on the 31st of August, 1997, there was a collapse of a parking structure at the airport. Three workers were killed, and that was the situation that created this large fine. We found multiple violations. We found basically a pretty laissez-faire kind of an attitude about safety. We found what we thought was very, very, very serious violations. And from that standpoint, we issued the largest fine that we've ever issued. The vast majority of our fines are not like that. They're more in the neighborhood of maybe hundreds of dollars if we fine people at all. Frankly, we think that when we go to a workplace and everything is in good shape, an in-compliance inspection says that the system's working all the way around. So it doesn't happen very often, but when it does happen, and when we find employers who are not taking care of the safety needs of their employees, then we feel as if we have to act with some rather serious sanctions.
And now that you're refreshing my memory about this tragedy, I recollect it. But was the fine levied against the contractor, or was the fine levied against the Port of Portland, or was it shared responsibility?
This particular fine, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, was levied against a subcontractor who was doing the steel erection.
Madam Chair,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
That's all right.
I'm not doing well today.
I know you're in trouble today. That's
Robin's
fine.
Feeling much better.
That helps a lot. How long have I got to go, Robin?
A week.
That's it.
Oh, dear.
Were there no complaints against the subcontractor over a period of time, even prior jobs? I mean, you don't suddenly hit a job and become laissez-faire about safety conditions. And my experience with construction workers is that at least half of them, most of them, take their safety fairly seriously. Most of them have seen somebody killed on the job or seriously injured. And so I guess I'm surprised if there weren't any complaints.
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, this was a contractor that has very little experience in Oregon. It's a contractor, I believe they're from Detroit. They had one job in the Eugene area where they had an accident and where we'd issued citations. We worked with them on that job and felt as if they had gotten our message. This was only the second time that we had dealt with them, and frankly they have not had much business in the state ever since. So it's pardon me?
Have they paid their fine?
No.
Okay.
They are still under appeal.
Oh gee, okay.
Questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hayden.
And they are out of state. They are under appeal and out of state.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, that's correct. But they're still, we are scheduled to go to hearing sometime this summer.
The case is here in Oregon.
The case will be here in Oregon, yes.
Thank you. Representative Johnson. Given this kind of a track history for a contractor, were they to pop back up on some other large job in Oregon, would there be a mechanism to alert you to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, yes, there would.
Want to share that? I'm new here. How you doing?
Well, you know, I mean, there's a lot of word of mouth in the construction industry, and that's probably the mechanism for this sort of thing. We have lists of people who are working in Oregon. It's a little bit more difficult with somebody who comes into the state from out of state. For example, we have numerous small employers that come across the border from Vancouver, Washington, or other places in Washington. But the large employers, generally speaking, keep us pretty well apprised of who's doing business in the state. I have every confidence that if this company were busy in the state somewhere, we would find out about it in short order. In fact, they did do a job down in Medford, and we were aware of that, and we sent inspectors out and did an inspection down there.
During the pendency of this appeal?
Yes.
Okay, continue, please.
Well, the next program I want to talk about, and I've already touched on it a little bit, is our training program. This program not only puts on the conferences that I spoke of, but it also puts on training events in all different parts of the state. We did 400 different events last year. There are 19 positions in this particular unit, including 7 full-time trainers whose job it is to simply go out whenever there is a need or a request and put on training classes so that people can learn more about safety and health and whatnot. And the last program that I want to talk about is our technical program. In our technical section, we have 17 positions. These people are responsible for developing new rules, for promulgating the rules, for interpreting the rules, and they do interpretations both for our staff and also for the. If you would have a question, you could call our technical section and get interpretations over the telephone with respect to various rules that we might have. They also have a resource library where people can check out video materials and use it as a reference library for numerous other kinds of safety and health related research. So this is a pretty active section as well.
And Johnson.
Does a firewall exist between the technical section and the enforcement section as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, we don't have the same kind of firewall. There is no the firewall between enforcement and consultation is statutory. We don't have that with technical. Ordinarily, people don't call the technical section and say, I think I'm in violation, though. They just call up and ask us for interpretation of our code. You know, it's interesting, though, while I'm on this subject and talking about our enforcement people and becoming more user-friendly, if you will, we have had an increasing number of employers calling enforcement people, calling our compliance officers, the people who have been out to inspect them and say, well, now I'm going to do this. What do you think about it? So our compliance officers are offering this same kind of thing. It used to be a really huge concern, the firewall thing, but it just isn't the same kind of concern anymore. Now, I know that there are still some employers out there who are very concerned about it and really want that protection, and they can get it from consultation. But there are a lot of employers, I'm really pleased to say, that do call the last inspector that came out and get help from them, too. Well, our general philosophy is expressed in our strategic plan, and you'll find that the three strategic goals that we have on page 47. Basically, the first one and the one that we think is most important is a workplace culture goal. We want to change the workplace culture in Oregon to increase employer and worker awareness of commitment to and involvement with safety and health. This particular goal, we view it as a self-sufficiency goal. If you do the numbers, we have 80 compliance officers. There are 80,000 businesses in the state of Oregon and 120,000 different work locations. So those compliance officers can't be in those work locations very often. If we're going to get safer in Oregon, if we're going to continue to see reductions in fatalities and injuries and incidents that relate to worker safety and health, we have to help employers get more and more self-sufficient. That's where we want to put most of our resources. And so that's our number one goal. Our number two goal is a reduced injury goal. It is to improve workplace safety and health for all workers, as evidenced by fewer hazards, reduced exposures, fewer injuries and illnesses, and fatalities. And you would certainly expect that to be a goal of any organization whose goal it is to advance and improve workplace safety and health. This is a goal that we take very seriously, but we still subordinate it to the self-sufficiency goal just because of the numbers of people that we have working for us. And our number three goal is public confidence. I like this because I'm kind of a government junkie and have been involved in government for a long, long time. But that goal is to continuously strengthen public confidence through the excellence in delivery and development of our OSHA programs and services. As far as I'm concerned, And this ties back into some of our service orientation. If a business's only contact with the government of the state of Oregon is through Oregon OSHA, whatever they think of all of us in government is going to be based upon that one contact. If they think we've helped them, then they're going to think a whole lot better of us than they do if they think that we just come in and beat them up. And for that reason, we do want to continuously strengthen public confidence through the delivery of our services to Oregon businesses. And I see that as a really important goal myself.
Mr. DeLuca, how many open cases, for lack of a better terminology, do you have at any given time?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, we have, I guess what you're asking me is how many inspections are there that are open, or are you asking me how many appeals are open?
Probably the latter.
Okay.
But let me tell you the framework I'm trying to get
sure.
a handle on. There are 80,000 businesses in Oregon, and you have 80 compliance officers.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty high ratio of businesses to officers.
Right.
And I'm trying to think of testimony from some other agencies that we've heard in this same room where they're talking about the number of inspectors they have to the number of either practitioners or and lots of open cases that are either seeking some kind of judicial closure or are pending investigation internally. And I'm trying to get a sense of how efficient your compliance folks are in dealing with these businesses. Were I a business and were I to have a compliance problem, what's my waiting time in the queue to have my issue resolved, given the small number of compliance officers to the number of businesses? How long does it take you to process a case?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, now that zeroes in your question, I know just how to answer it. From the time that we come out to your business and we say we're here to give you an inspection, and we do what we call an opening conference. We have 6 months to tell you what the final result of that is. Most of our inspections are closed in about half that time, 3 months, 4 months, very few of them run all the way out to 6 months. Now, what we will do when we leave your business after the inspection is we have a closing conference. And that is usually within a couple of weeks of the time that we have left. Sometimes it's even the day that we leave. It depends on what your business is, and it depends on how detailed a report we're going to write, et cetera. And in that period of time, we'll sit down and we'll go through with you the problems that we have found, if we found any, and what you need to do to correct them so that you'll be ready when you get our letter that says you need to correct these problems to begin corrective action. Once you get the final notice of citation, if that's what happens, then you have 20 days to appeal that action, and it's an appeal directly to the Workers' Compensation Board. In that process, I don't know that there are any time limits, but usually most appeals get taken care of within about a year. About 85% of the citations we write are never appealed. Of the 15% that are appealed, we will meet and do what we call an informal conference, which is an appeal procedure. We will meet and have a discussion with you as a business and try to work out some kind of a solution where you agree that you're going to accept some responsibility and do some things, and maybe we'll say, well, we can overlook some of these other things, or maybe we simply say, well, you need to do all of these things. If you say, yeah, okay, let's work out a way to deal with those situations, then the appeal is resolved. And of the 15% of the cases that get into the informal appeals process, again, we resolve about 85% of the appeals. So that leaves, I don't know, my math is a little bit bad, but that probably leaves maybe 5% of our cases that we've written a citation on that actually go through a hearing, and those would be resolved within about a year. In the last biennium, we had a couple of budget notes. You'll find those on page 52. We were asked to explore options for implementation of an apprenticeship program and report to the emergency board. We appointed a committee. It included members of the legislature. We developed a proposal. We reported to the e-board in November. And we had originally submitted one option package which would create the two positions which are necessary to implement this program. As you've heard, we have the problem of the shrinking fund that we are needing to address, the premium assessment operating account, and we're going to be proposing, and I'll talk to you about them in just a minute, some reductions in staff. And we felt that if we were going to propose reductions in staff, we should not go forward with, at the same time, increasing other staff. I've spoken personally with the legislators who were involved in the creation of this budget note and in the committee process where we developed the apprenticeship committee, the apprenticeship program. Senator Representative Leonard was one of those people. Senator Castillo and Representative Backlund were the other two, and all three of them agree that if we're going to be cutting positions, then it would be not appropriate to go forward with trying to add positions. So we have proposed the elimination of that particular package. Second budget note that we had was to...
Senator Dukes, that's fine. Have you had any conversations with the Attorney General's office about the way the apprenticeship programs are currently run? And the reason I ask that is I was told recently that, this is some time back, we created the equivalent of apprenticeship programs to the Board of Maritime Pilots for river pilots and bar pilots, and those are run very similar, I believe, to the other plumbing and electrical apprenticeship programs. That is, that the river pilots and the bar pilots do the training and oversee the work and make the recommendations. And I was told recently that the Attorney General's office has determined that the board has to have, of maritime pilots, must have a greater role in those apprenticeship programs, or they don't meet the criteria of training programs that we need to have. And considering the fact that there's no board with a really big role in the, I mean, I think the apprenticeship programs we have are good, but there's, I'm just wondering, I wondered at the time why they wouldn't be the same.
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, easy answer to your question is no, we didn't have any conversations with DOJ. I could only speculate, but what we were trying to create here was a situation where we could bring in at a very, well, actually a below entry level, people who had some experience in some of the things that we regulate. Particularly, we were looking at farm laborers as a possibility to bring them into and mainstream them into our system. And there we would have some control over that whole thing. I think that maybe, and I'm only speculating, but maybe the marine pilots situation is somewhat different because there are really stringent rules in terms of those apprenticeship programs and learning requirements and a whole bunch of other things like that before you put a ship or people or anything else in the hands of somebody and have them help you get across the Columbia River Bar or something. Probably a lot different requirements than what we would have here. But like I said, the short answer to your question with respect to our programs, no, we did not talk to the agency about it. There isn't another apprenticeship program out there that is similar to this, though.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dukes, apprenticeship probably wasn't quite the right term to use. What we're looking at is in a training program to bring people in an underfilled situation so we can train them on the job to meet the qualifications of an inspector. And so it's not the kind of apprenticeship program that Bowling runs.
The second budget note that we had was a request of the legislature to maintain the level of farm labor housing inspections that we had been maintaining and to report to the E-Board. We did that. We maintained the level. We reported. Bottom line is there are a lot of registered camps out there that we keep going back to year after year. The unregistered camps are the worst ones. We feel it is probably going to be of more value if we go back to the unregistered camps instead of going to the registered camps. And if we do that, the numbers of inspections will go down a little bit because the unregistered camps are a lot harder to find. They don't give us their address. And we reported this as well to the e-board. Our budget request is for $37.1 million. You'll find it on page 51. It's an overall reduction from current service level of $2.3 million. The reduction includes 17 positions and the withdrawal of the option package that I just spoke about. It would leave us at 236 positions. The budget request would eliminate the worksite redesign program, three positions. It would eliminate six consultants. It would eliminate six compliance officers and also two administrative and management service positions. In closing, I'd just like to say I think we provide a valuable service to business and labor. We're confident that if you spoke to leaders in both of these areas, they would both agree. And with that, I turn it over to Satish.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee. I will be Satish Chakravarti with the Department of Administrative Services. And if you turn to page 50, the presentation document, I will just briefly tell you how the governor's budget was developed for Oregon Ocean. The starting point was the 9901 legislatively adopted budget. This consists of $35.8 million total funds. There was one e-board emergency board action, which increased it by $976,966. This is for employee compensation cost increases that is provided all over state government. And you will see some base budget and position adjustments. These are all related to personal services, and these numbers are system generated. With that, we have the base budget of $38.4 million total funds. The essential packages, the vacancy factor was increased in package 010 by $255,678, and there was the non-personal information control systems adjustment for unemployment, overtime, temporaries, and mass spends and taxes. An increase of $31,436. Next, on package 030, you will see the usual cost increases for inflation and price list. And I did provide you a handout from Sarah Gates on the reasons for the increase on the uniform rent, a 13.4% increase. If you have any other questions on that, I'll be happy to answer. So with that, we have the current service level budget of $39.4 million total funds. The policy package Pete just talked to you about, that has been withdrawn by the agency, and Pete also talked to you about the adjustments to the governor's recommended budget. So with that, we have the governor's revised budget of $37.1 million total funds, $235.08 full-time equivalent positions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Butler.
A question under package 030, the increased shift in state government service charges. Satish, that $228,205, what's that add back? I'm sorry, I don't recognize that right off.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, that's also that you see in all state agency budgets, that these are like charges like the Department of Administrative Services charges and other state government charges. We do an adjustment based on what the charges are during the current biennium and what the charges are during 01, 03. So this is... It's an adjustment based on the prices.
So that's just the Department of Administrative Services gross up then is what that is separated out from the base budget.
Representative Butler, that's one of the major components of state government service charges.
Yes, I know that we increased those Department of Administrative Service charges, but I think that's the first time I've actually seen it as a separate number as an add back.
Any other questions? Is that it?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Any further questions of the committee? Not so.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's my expectation we will finish up with the Workers' Compensation Board presentation tomorrow and then move into work session on these three divisions.
If anyone has any questions, either Debbie or anyone else about those before we get into work session, I hope you feel much better tomorrow. See you tomorrow. We are adjourned.